afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks very much for showing up. If you weren't here this morning, I'm Chris Forster. I'm going to introduce folks, and then I'm going to sit down and let them let you speak for themselves. We have a panel of three folks talking about some issues of teaching and research this afternoon. And then at 3:30, we will have a keynote from Dan Cohen with Professor Boone Gann responding very generously. And I'll try and have about 5 minutes in between those so people can break, retail coffee, and do whatever they feel like. To my right, I will introduce them in the order in which they will be speaking. This is Professor Allison Booth. Many of you know her, no doubt. Professor of English. She's the author of How to Make It as a Woman, Collective Biographical History from Victoria to Present. She is currently continuing her work on collective biographies of women as an IAC fellow, which I'm speaking to about that work today. Professor Mitch Green, all the way to the right, is the NEH Horace Goldsmith Distinguished Teaching Professor of Philosophy. Professor Green specializes in philosophy of language, philosophy of mind, and aesthetics. He has held fellowships from the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Andrew Mellon Foundation, and many, many others. His book, I hope I have this right, Self-Expression, was just released this year in paperback, which means that I think at least two books I've been encouraging you to buy. Professor Green is an associate fellow at IAS starting this year with a project related to question he will be discussing today, can surprise not to be digitized. And then finally, Professor Benjamin Wren is a professor of religious studies. His teaching and research is focused on indigenous religions of sub-Saharan Africa. He directs the Salem Witch Trials documentary archive, which we're speaking about today. And just last night, I missed it, but he was in the documentary about a documentary about the Salem Witch Trials on the National Geographic. Yeah, is that not right?
Yes.
So that's like a celebrity here in our midst.
Thanks for coming out today. And the room is full of collaborators on this project, so if I get something wrong, there'll be people to tell you. And I just wanted to say, based on the wonderful keynote this morning, that yes to Steve and yes to Ramsey and great Brad. I thought it was good. So the title of my talk is Telling Thousands of Women's Lives, Humanities in a Digital Analysis of Nonfiction Narrative, and it's part of this Humanities in a Digital World Symposium, is what I'm calling this symposium. So digital literary studies today have more to contribute to conceptual than technological innovation. Or at least someone like myself can make a bigger difference in digital humanities, which I'm going to shorten to DH for time purposes, which can do very nicely without me by using all my critical tools in addition to computers and software and teams of collaborators. Nothing is easier than letting the display of the new distract from the local or long view, making some kinds of scholarly work, hard labor, look unwarrantably foolish. Certainly, we should save our Kasabans from seeking a key to all mythologies in haystacks of SGML. Let's not perfect the Edsel or plump for coal when we should be pursuing green energy. Yet, the new methods, so I am saying yes to the new methods, yes to Ramsey to some extent, yes to technology. The new methods may sometimes become ends in themselves, or may obscure the fact that the project is fundamentally repackaging and multiplying an old-fashioned enterprise of textual editing of classics or telling the history of the Civil War. Not that there's anything wrong with that. So I'm talking today about my project, which has what I'm talking about today is essentially going to show you materials from the Scholars Lab phase. And as was said, I'm one of the resident fellows at IAF. So it is what we're working on now is very different from what can be seen online, although it's certainly extending it. And among my collaborators, I should say, I'm also collaborating now with Suzanne Keene at Washington and Lee on narrative theory, and talking with Jason Boyd, who's an assistant professor of digital humanities at Ryerson, about doing a digital project on biography that would combine both of our work. So CBW extends my longstanding investigation of the forms, gender ideology, social networks, and historical contexts of third-person life narratives, not autobiography, in collections, not monographs. A study of a specific subgenre of prosopography. This isn't primarily an online biographical reference work. We study the biographical texts, word, and image, especially their narrative techniques. Although this is a feminist literary project, it is not about women writers. And every time someone asks me about it, they remember women writers because that's what feminist literary historians have mostly been working on. We focus on a neglected genre, biography. And it is based on that the book that Chris mentioned. The genre is perhaps difficult for outsiders to describe, but it consists of biographies that don't leave one person alone, but shape lives into groups. These nonfiction collected narratives are most often written by men, and they feature almost any conceivable occupation, so they're not focused on women writers. The wealth of contradictory examples makes this a fascinating data set of representations of women. Now that fancy word I uttered, prosopography, circulates versions of personae. And computers are an obviously well-suited aid to multiply and study that multiplicity. As nonfiction, the archive of printed books proliferates versions of documented individuals. It would be quite insane for people to write this many versions of a fictional character. Because there was a real woman, it's not at all seen to be as absurd to continue to reproduce versions of this life. Like historiography, it predicates, prosopography as I'm talking about, it predicates an imagined community. Like eulogy or hagiography, as in saints' legends, it inscribes types. The facts receive polite interest in these narratives, but the famous women's lives are cut and paste reprints of unattributed previous texts designed to remodel the reader. Authors are relatively fungible in this discourse. It really doesn't matter so much who wrote them. It's kind of crowdsourced social networking in some way before, you know, in the print era, as I call it. Now, I'm just going to quickly introduce the project as it is now. So this is going to be a series. This is the montage in the film. So some ways that you can look at the project at this point. It has been moving beyond an online bibliography. So this is the homepage at the moment. This would be a result from searching for a book that includes a woman named Sister Dora in the bibliography that's online now. And you might notice the links to WorldCat and Google Books. This is just a snapshot of one of the tools that's adapted from my book, the pop chart, which helps us sort of measure the rates of appearance of different women. We've had a whole project on featured subjects. There are only 21 of them at this point, but we're going to be multiplying these sort of biographical portals for studying particular women. And one of my points of pride, and this is how teaching comes into my talk, is that I've used students as well as research assistants to help write, to build these featured subject pages, but also to write the biographies. Now, this is going to drive some of the people in the room nuts because this is our very provisional database, but I wanted to just sort of point out that it also consists of a database that we're working on. CBW is a historical study of more than 7,000 women in some 1,200 books, but it's also an experiment in narrative theory, a field that has done little with biography. For a few years, we've been developing studies of narrative structure through an archive of digitized text as well as scanned page images of the 14 Lola Montez books and 19 Sister Dora books, groups of types that we nickname Women of the World and Noble Workers. Now, I'm going to return later to some brief remarks about these personae, but what's the most late-breaking for us is something that I'll talk about now, which is our schema. So In XML, we create analyses of narratives using a standoff schema, which we insisted was a woman's name, so it's Biography Elements and Structure Schema, or BESS. Not to edit the text, but to tag various elements linked to units of the text in order to compare versions of one life, various types of persons and collections, and assorted slices of the archive. And I think it's a tool for interpreting any biographical network. A contribution, this is sort of, so that's what BESS is. A contribution to DH doesn't require me to check all my critical tools, my entire toolbox at the door. I'm a feminist cultural historian focusing on printed texts. And I am a narrative theorist focusing on biography. I've argued that digital literary projects require a form of reading or interpretation, all forms, in fact, and they were mentioned this morning, beginning to mention them. So not just the kind of traditional close reading, but obviously Franco Moretti's idea of distant reading. These are all spatial metaphors, notably. An idea of surface reading, and you could call it depth, but people have often called it symptomatic or ideology critique. You're looking for the hidden meanings, what the text doesn't say. And I think digital humanities requires all those kinds of reading. The BESS schema is designed for a fusion of these dimensions of reading. A quantitative extension to a distance scale of a body of close textual analyses designed to reveal the ideological commitments of this particular subgenre, notably class, gender, nation, and race, based upon a combination of the surface reading techniques advocated by Sharon Marcus and Stephen Best, including book history, attention to historical data about persons, places, times, and of course, the kind of patterns revealed by text analysis tools. So one of the key elements that we mark in BESS is stages of life. And this is where you have to be humble and just admit that literary history kind of is there ahead of us. Classical theories of plot help us to identify the basic structure of this kind of biography. It does have a beginning, middle, and end, and this would be one of the main things we try to mark up in BESS. Now, a lot of us in this room, can immediately think of ways to squeeze information out of a textual corpus like this. This past week at the Victorianist Conference, I shared a panel with Natalie Houston, who describes her project Reading Victorian Poetry Digitally. She showed how methods of Stéphane Sinclair's Hyperpo and Voyeur, the text analysis tool offered by hermeneuta.canada.ca, Sinclair and Jeffrey Rockwell's project, she showed how those tools had helped her focus in on, quantify, and visualize a pivotal point in Rossetti's sonnet sequence, The House of Life, when life literally gives way to death. Our own Paul Fife, who's now at Florida State, on the same panel, called attention to crowdsourced editing, and he was talking about being a wombat in the Rossetti archive, as in the Transcribe Bentham project, which draws on protocols of gaming and extends the potential of research into realms of serious leisure. These are all methods that I can imagine using in the CBW project. Franco Moretti and his Lit Lab colleagues share my desire to trace temporospatial and narrative patterns across genres and entire literary traditions. And like Dan Cohen and his collaborators, we can use Google Books or other digital archives to follow trends in titles. And at the same conference, I heard a talk about a database of all pantomimes, all English pantomimes, tracing the changes in their titles. Kate Newey and other people at the University of Birmingham in the UK. All of these approaches appeal to me, but for now, in CBW, we are evolving a digital morphology of a kind of narrative. So briefly, the pilot projects we're working on right now. Sister Dora was a self-willed and recklessly self-sacrificing surgical nurse, hospital administrator, and inspiration to the victims of industrial accidents in the British Midlands from 1868 to 1878, and was considered a modern saint. And a statue was erected to her in this place near Birmingham. In books that include Sister Dora, there are over 120 other women, some recurring numerous times, many well-known in transatlantic 19th century European American women's culture, such as Florence Nightingale and other philanthropists and reformers, Maria Edgeworth and other writers, the Brontes, for instance, Queen Victoria, Joan of Arc, Mrs. Gladstone, and Antigone, and the astronomer Caroline Herschel, a different kind of sister. And I've talked about how Sister Dora and Caroline Herschel, who is in books of great sisters. And I use this slide partly to show how people start to resemble each other in the same book. This is from the same collection. Now, Lola Montez is a completely different kind of woman. She's looking in a different direction, obviously. Though, like Sister Dora, she became famous under a professional alias and died a pious death of natural causes in her 40s, Lola Montez never darkens the door of the network of noble workers. Yet, Sister Dora books, with their Salvation Army crusaders, appear in the same time frame, 1880 to 1930, as Lola Montez assortments with their pretty horse breakers and gunslingers, such as Lives of 12 Bad Women. So we do work with titles, and it's interesting to just, you know, find the different keywords in the titles of Sister Dora books. Little hard for you to see, but that's a search result, and then eminent, famous, notable, good, peerless, and titles of Lola Montez books, terms of adventure, frailty, sin, domination, Seven Splendid Sinners, that sort of thing. The topoi of progress and social service, of bringing sunshine into darkness, seem reversed with Lola. Presenters of adventuresses, which is the occupational term that the Oxford Dictionary of National Biography assigns to Sister Dora, Lola Montez. She is adventurous, often mock or rebuke their subjects rhetorically. They're very different from the more hagiographical. Autobiography, she wrote a specious one. Journalism, previous biographies, plays play fast and loose, as if seduced by the outrageous women, celebrated for their beauty, illicit relations to famous men, or embodied performance. Women of the World, Lola's cohort, you see how she doesn't really look the same in different images. That's the other interesting thing about portraits. People begin to look alike, but they don't resemble themselves. Women of the World, Lola's cohort, often have stage names or noble titles, dress or pass as men, participate in war or revolution, get on the wrong side of the law, die young, at times they are murdered. We will be moving from Beth's analyses of all versions of Sister Dora and Lola Montez to analyze the versions of any woman also in those collective biographies. Some common grounds among the types leap out with the human eye reading, but we can trace patterns across many dimensions of this archive. The 100 women named in our Women of the World sample largely begin in poverty and disreputable occupations, and deploy their cleverness, bodily charm, mobility to rise to title or fame. A closer look at subjects that join Lola Montez in 2 to 4 books yields some common traits, including exoticism, foreign birth or travel, and public display of sexuality or masculine feats. Calamity Jane Belle Star are both common in Lola Montez books. A remarkable number of these notorious women were performed by Sarah Bernhardt by early film stars. For instance, Theodora, an actress prostitute circa 500 AD who became empress and wife of Justinian and is also a saint. I can't detail here the overlapping elements, but these names give the idea in this sample of a book's titles. Irish Peg Woffington and French Adrienne Lecouvreur, actresses. Cleopatra and Emma Hart, Lady Hamilton, mistresses of leaders. Jeanne du Barry, also a mistress of a leader, implicated in the affair of the necklace that helped bring down the French monarchy, and Lola Montez brought down Ludwig I. You never get a nude picture of Sister Dora, I kind of assure you. Edmund d'Auvergne's Adventuresses and Adventurous Ladies, published in London and New York in 1927, writes, Lola's biography is starred with the names of great men and transports us to the four quarters of the globe. I mean, it gets spatially extremely interesting. Are the heroines confined to one place, like a local saint, or are they globetrotters? Wherever she went, things began to happen. Indeed, we could tell you this without titles, tables of contents, paratexts, portraits, or even their names. We could begin to tell you about the high incidence of evaluation or versions of story compared, disputed. That's one of our values for our markup. The narrative structure turns out to be different. The majority of the 19 Sister Dora narratives begin with her birth and move chronologically forward with certain key or kernel events that we have begun to name in order, because restricted to a certain range of event types. Nursing professional, those of us, there's some people in the room who've had to do some of this best analysis, and nursing, comma, professional comes up a whole lot with Sister Dora. That's what she did for her entire career. The 14 Lola Montez analyses, which are in progress, show a wider spectrum of events, many of which never occur in Sister Dora's lives. As one biography said, she packed into her years a dozen lives. She receives very little narrated beginning, remember the stages of life, often tucked in as an afterthought because she was busy hiding her birth. She had nothing whatsoever to do with Spain or nobility. The middle of her life, her debut and chosen profession, often occurs in the paragraph range of 1 and 2. The biographies often begin with her debut, which is, as always with her debuts, also a humiliation and a scandal, and usually a fight. She usually gets into some kind of violence pretty quickly. In a life of starting over, Lola Montez's, there are recurrent crises. One narrator calls it scandals strangely monotonous. Though most versions focus on the rise and fall in Munich that I already mentioned, where she brings down a monarch and is chased away by a revolutionary mob. Then she makes a living performing herself in this drama. I mean, there's a play about the Munich episode, which stars Lola Montez. For heroines of fiction, marriage can be the culmination or end. Sister Dora never marries. In Lola's life, marriage occurs in the beginning, in her teens, before she has found her vocation, in the middle, when she commits bigamy, and much later. This is just going to give you a little bit of a sense of how we are, for our own analytic purposes, internally displaying. This is not at all what the interface would be, but some of the text of a Lola Montez adventure in a book I already mentioned, with some of the, you know, display of what we've been doing. And I'll just very quickly read to you, when Lola Montez was apprised that her arrest was ordered, she barricaded her door, and when the police arrived, she sat behind it with a pistol in her hand, declaring she would certainly shoot the first man dead who should break in. The police were frightened, etc., and then she is forced away and quits Warsaw, but the same episode more or less happens when she has to quit other places as well. And then in the second paragraph, the incident marks the final transformation of the British officer's wife into the international adventuress. Just a lot has happened within that paragraph. Temporally, a lot is condensed in her life, but there's a lot of sort of extended repetition, too. It becomes extremely interesting when you look at the fine grain. So we need the close reading as well as the distant. Analysis of narrative structure, event, and agent types, narrative discourse, and other elements will reveal conventions of biography, helping us to sort and measure social category, while we reveal the correlation of thematic interpretation of individuals, occupations, and types with various narrative features. So both the social and the formal are being measurably compared. I expect this to reinforce my argument in the book about prosopography, but also to show what can be done with a genre of nonfiction narrative in digital contexts. So, finally, Johanna Drucker recently argued that digital humanities have been enamored of quantitative visualizations suited to social and natural sciences, whereas humanists offer qualitative interpretation. All data, in fact, is capta, or taken rather than given. It's not so much that humanities need to advance into the digital age, but that digital studies need to take stock of the most advanced approaches to humanistic inquiry. Humanists are more than curators or editors. Interpretation of character and narrative within social networks and historical context is something human beings are pretty good at. Though inconsistent at, and physically we're limited in time and place and perception. Computers can quantify and multiply and illustrate such interpretation among many collaborators and users. In this spirit, I realize that the human hand leaves its imprint everywhere in CBW. Thanks.
Right. Well, where Allison's discussion was of a sophisticated and an advanced project, I'm going to talk about my little baby in diapers by comparison. So lower your expectations way down and bear with me. First, I'll give you a little bit of background. Yes, here it is. About 5 years ago, I found myself convinced that there's a strange gap in American education, at least maybe elsewhere in the world, but certainly here at the high school level, because very few kids in high school get much exposure of a respectable kind, at least, to philosophy. That happens most likely, most often, in private schools and religious schools, but hardly ever, as far as I can tell, in my unscientific survey on the matter. In public schools, for example, in very good public schools, I find that, generally speaking, a full philosophy class in public schools is the exception to the norm. But I also find myself having given a number of talks to high school groups that kids at age 16 and 17 can get this stuff. They understand how to get into discussion about free will or personal identity, right and wrong, things of that sort. So I felt like there was a gap there, together with the fact that this my corner of the humanities is, like many others, always in a fragile state relative to the other things that are present by universities and education budgets and so forth. So I thought that one way to try to see whether we could strengthen our particular corner and perhaps make a long-term investment in its viability would be to see whether we could plant the seed of interest in philosophy in 16 and 17-year-olds. So by the time they get to college, they don't necessarily think of philosophy as a sort of appetizer on the menu before they major in business. And so I began to form something I called Project Hi-Fi, High School Philosophy. Eric Rogers, my web designer, is the person who came up with that icon, of which I'm a little bit proud, I confess. And he's been able to put together other things that are part of the overall project. So, for example, I'll just to give you the large-scale perspective, a couple of different things that we've done. Going back to the beginning here. So Project Hi-Fi supports... Whoops, where'd you go? Go back. I'm not completely in control. philosophical education in America's high school, and it was born in the conviction that students at that level can and should be exposed to more if we can do it properly. Secondly, last year we had an essay contest for Virginia high school students. Had a good time with that. Had an award ceremony in the spring and so forth. This year we're trying to go national if we can get the appropriate funding. I'm starting up a forum where teachers and students and faculty members of various kinds can write essays of a relatively popular kind on philosophical topics. Last summer I ran an institute supported by the National Endowment for the Humanities here on grounds for 3 weeks of intensive exposure for third high school teachers to get immersed in philosophy and hope they'll go back to their schools and try to teach some. Not necessarily in the form of a full semester philosophy course. In some cases, in fact, I think most of them will go back to the schools and do things like, for example, if they're a teacher of literature, they might want to try to organize a more systematic discussion of the ethical dilemmas that some of the characters confront in novels that they're studying. For example, or a science teacher wants to talk more about what it means for us to confirm or disconfirm a theory, that's philosophy of science and epistemology. Can they incorporate those things into the classes? That's the kind of thing I was trying to help the teachers, my colleagues and I in the philosophy department who will help to teach it as well, or trying to help teachers learn how to do. This last spring and in the coming semester, we've had and will have internships where our high school students, where undergraduates who've had some exposure to philosophy will work with area teachers, high school teachers, to try to help them incorporate philosophy into the courses. And then, finally, what else is here? One of the teachers from our institute, the NEH Institute, last summer, is going to start a charter school in California. And again, it's all sort of getting away from me. See if I can do that. A charter school in California that's somehow, not sure exactly how it's going to work, but based on the idea, I'm not clicking through it, based on the idea of incorporating philosophy at all levels of high school education. So we'll see how that goes. But one project was to try to develop this thing called Be Socratic, and I don't know why I'm not being able to click through any of these things here. I'll try something else. But because of the... I was kind of trying to think of a good acronym, and that didn't come out all that well, and it's got various sort of connections with letters at the beginning that you might want to make fun of. And so Robbie Bingler, somebody at IAF, perhaps just unintentionally came up with what I think is a better name for it. So let's go directly to that, called Socratic Method Online. And if I can get a research experience grant from the National Science Foundation, which I think I'll apply for this summer, that would be SMORE, which is kind of fun. But we'll see if we can. All right, so... what happens here is an attempt to do some kind of dialectical structure online, where I think my approach to philosophy is not particularly historical, or at least not primarily historical. It's not so much, here's a Plato thought, here's an Aristotle thought, and then we get to Descartes and Kant and medievals and Aristotle people. That's all good and interesting, but the core for me tends to be thinking about questions. Let's start with a question. For example, is the will free? What, if anything, is the difference between right actions and wrong actions? Say what that difference consists in. What, if any, kind of obligations do we have to a state, especially if we're a member of that state? What does it mean to know something? Does knowledge come to anything more than prejudice or something of the sort? And there are various answers that we can consider. And, of course, the famous philosophers in Western other traditions have had things to say about that. But for me, at the basis, at the core, are the questions and computed answers to those questions. So that's how I have begun to develop this project here. So let's suppose that you were interested in the problem of free will and were wondering whether, for example, you had any. And my daughter and I spent some very pleasant hours lying tummy down on the living room floor a couple months ago, in which you drew a big poster which lots with questions and various branches and nodes and so forth. And then the good folks at IAF, Worthy and Dan Timmy and Robbie Bingler helped to put some of this into a digital format. And the idea is you can try to engage with real philosophical questions in this form. Now, I'm not saying for a minute that this is going to be better than having a one-on-one conversation with someone who's an expert on these topics. But it might be a reasonable approximation if, for example, you don't have access to something like that because you're in a rural school or a not very well-supported school that doesn't have anybody on the staff who knows much about philosophy but you're still curious, or because you want to think these things through on your own and would like to be able to do so without necessarily being stared at by an overbearing professor or something like that. And I'm also going to say, I hope we'll have time to talk about the ways in which this could also be a source for research, not just for understanding, learning about the stuff that is more or less established. And the idea of stuff that's more or less established is, if the question, do we have free will, there are relatively few, relatively clear things we can mean about that. So one way of understanding the question, do we have free will, is that free will is the ability to do as you choose, in at least some cases, not necessarily all, but some. So one exercise of your free will by, for instance, deciding whether to wiggle your left pinky and then doing so or not on the basis of that choice. Having free will does not entail being able to, for example, make choices about everything, however. Thus, you may have free will even though you don't have any choice as to when you were born or who your parents are or were. So that's a question, and you might, well, say yes or no. And the idea is inspired by the thought, and I wouldn't say this online, but inspired by the thought that a teacher of mine way back long ago said when I started graduate school, his remark was, philosophers are people who hang upside down naked throwing darts at each other. And I thought, that's just absurd, that's ridiculous, this doesn't make any sense at all. But I began to feel like it's actually perhaps right, because no matter what position you take in philosophy, it's going to be controversial. There are going to be problems with it. There are going to be ways to object to it. You're going to be vulnerable in some way. And so trying hard here to be not dogmatic, to get students to see, at any level to see, that no matter what position you take on a philosophical issue, there's going to be some reasonable way of objecting what you're saying. And you need to own that position and maybe think about how to respond to that objection. So the question is, suppose you say, yes, we do have free will, darn it. So you can click on that, and look how this thing rearranges itself. I just think that's so awesome. So you know, what I like about it is that you know that you still have this action over here. You can go back there if you want. But this ends up being a focus now. And you say, okay, there are two possible ways of supporting the affirmative answer. Yes, we have free will. And I should say, of course, we might be able to think of others, but these are two that came to mind when my daughter and I were lying dummy down. One, and I'm not sure how well a cup that shows up for you, especially doesn't back, because the world's not deterministic, you might say. There are, as it were, exceptions to the general rule that says events have prior sufficient conditions, and we're going to have to see what that comes to. Or you might say, because free will is just plain compatible with determinism. The idea that every event has a prior sufficient condition doesn't pose any threat at all to freedom of will. So let's go to the development of this. So the yellow is things that are in yellow are answers, things that are in white are questions, things that are in blue are supports for those answers. And you could give further support to that one on the left. Choose one. You might say the reason why the world's not deterministic is because, for example, quantum mechanics shows that some events have no prior sufficient conditions. The decay of a uranium-238 atom or something like that does not have a prior sufficient condition. The most you can say about it is that there was some probability that it would decay in a certain period of time. You might say, that's why we have free will, because the world's not deterministic. Or you might take a different approach. Say, no, the reason is that agents cause events without themselves being caused to do so. So one philosophical position says what makes us free is that we are sources of agency, sources of actions, but those actions that we ourselves produce are not themselves caused. And suppose you wanted to say a little more about that quantum theory. Now, when something's red, you can imagine that's an objection. So here's an objection. Here's the doctor coming at you. Somebody might ask, there's an objection. Well, look, how could quantum mechanics make us free if we weren't free already in a deterministic world? And that corresponds to a famous objection to the idea of appealing to quantum mechanics to save free will that goes back to one Paul Taylor. And the idea is, look, if we weren't free in a world that was purely deterministic, no quantum determinacy at all, how would adding some quantum determinacy make us free? If anything, it would make us a little more chaotic, but it wouldn't give any source to the idea, any support to the idea that we are the causes of our own actions. Our actions happen to go through us, etc. So here on the right, I wrote a little bit of development of this idea of what quantum mechanics purports to show. And then there's an objection to the idea of somebody wants to appeal to quantum mechanics in order to save free will. So you say, all right, I give up. Pull that dart out of your skin and go over here. All right, fine. Well, agents have free will, and they are themselves the causes of actions. And then red, objection. You thought that was cool, but now you've got to worry about this. But look, isn't it odd that this little tiny corner of the universe is so unusual because of free will? I mean, there are these uncaused causes here on Earth, and so far as we know, there's nothing else in the entire vastness of the universe. Seems a little odd, don't you think? Maybe sort of ad hoc or something. That's not meant as a knockdown, drag-out objection, but it's something that should make you concerned about whether or not you have appealed to something to save the theory that is itself not independently very plausible. Generally, we think of this corner of the universe as not otherwise particularly special. But here's a reply. I'm not sure if it's the best color, but the, I don't know, mauve or something like that is an attempt to sort of reply to the objection as opposed to the objection itself, and so it would come as a further defense of that blue box up above. Maybe it's a very unusual corner after all. After all, we do find unusual things here. Otherwise, language, emotion, love, war, etc. And so maybe we shouldn't be so surprised. This is not the attempt to end the conversation, but it's an attempt to get the user to think about the ways in which an answer to a big question we've had of free will can itself be supported, and then those supports can fall upon various kinds of objections to which there can be various kinds of replies. This can go on for a long time, and my hope is that once people start using this, not just people at IAF, myself and so forth, but users around the country and maybe even the world can start using it, we'll begin to make suggestions as to further ways to develop that language. Right? So the idea is that this is trying to use some Socratic method where a person comes to understand what they think or should think about a certain kind of question, and in the process get to see some of the basic general problems of various theories, various answers to some of those questions, and try to make progress in their own thought. And if they've got ideas for another branch that should be added to that tree, or another objection that should be raised to a position, maybe there should be a third branch coming out of here, for example. Great. Want to hear about it.
That would be progress. That would be a way of teaching us something new. So far as I know, in the debates about freedom of will in metaphysics, there are only so many options that are available. If someone comes up with a new one, that would be fantastic. We'd all learn and be grateful. So let's go back to the rest of the tree. Suppose you want to say, no, we don't have free will. It's a bust. Because you might say the world's deterministic. And so there, you might say, look, neuroscience shows, or something like that, that things are deterministic at the level of the central nervous system, to which one might reply, well, and of course the overwhelming evidence suggests that that microscopic objects are governed by causal law, to which one might reply, but notice that answer just assumes that there can't be any compatibility between freedom of will and causal universal determinism. And that's a substantial philosophical assumption that just about every journalist I've ever read makes unbelievably. So it's worth noting and worth considering whether or not you have to assume that determinism and freedom of will are in fact incompatible. Maybe they're not. Maybe you should at least try to support why that is, and there are various ways in which you might do that. You might say, for example, well, the expression her action was free but determined, for example, is an oxymoron. It's a contradiction in terms, to which somebody might reply, well, wait a second, this idea of sounds odd. I haven't added a whole lot more. It does sound odd, but the fact that it sounds odd doesn't itself show anything conclusive. I'm not sure if I want to add this to the box itself or just have a comment on the sides. These are sort of elucidations of what goes on in the diagrams. What I wrote was, just because a phrase sounds odd does not imply that it's necessarily an oxymoron. There are many phrases and sentences whose odd ring may be just due to their being not often used. For example, Bob's eating pterodactyl. Sounds odd, but it's not an oxymoron. That's sort of happening. So the idea that something sounds odd shouldn't make us just give up on the project. Maybe we should try to push further. Okay, so the idea is that we start out with a general question, for example, do we have freedom of will? And then we think about various possible answers to that question. And each answer, affirmative or negative, is going to be given some kind of support. And each of those supports is going to have a possible objection to which it's prone. And then those objections are things which you might be able to reply with responses that rebut the objections or something of the sort. And the hope is that a newcomer to philosophy, for example, can get their bearings on some of the general philosophical questions by seeing how this dialectical structure works. That's the idea of Socratic method, and to some extent digitized. So I'm not prepared to say, by way of the affirmative, unfollowed by answer to the question, can Socratic method be digitized? Yes. But I do want to say, here's some reason to think you can make some progress along those lines. And I'm interested in, first of all, students that might not have access to the teachers who are prepared to give them, as it were, FaceTime with Socratic method. And I'm also interested in ways in which someone who can use this to get their feet in whatever form, whether they've got access to people who know philosophy or not, who might also think about new ways in which they can develop this structure, add more stuff to it, maybe help us make some progress in research on these questions and so forth. And I would like to think that in the fullness of time, once we've been able to establish a lot of these, what's called dialectics, for the various of the more basic and familiar philosophical questions, we can then move on to more advanced things. Things that, for example, a graduate student with an education might develop a dialectic for her position on her particular aspect of freedom of will, or the nature of philosophy of science, or philosophy of language, or ethics, or political philosophy, or something like that. That would be, I would like to think, not just a way in which she might help clarify her own thoughts, but also make them accessible to others. And it might also be the case that by seeing this line of thought, not just in prose, in the form of paragraphs and chapters and so forth, but laid out here, things will arise for her. Options, intellectual options will present themselves that might not otherwise have been obvious.
And so in that respect, I'm hoping it'll be a support for research as well. Let's see if I can go back and show you a little bit about ethics. So you're wondering now, I can tell, what makes right acts right?
So another case study. Well, you might say from the Kantian tradition, it's a matter of intentions. Or you might say, well, from the utilitarian tradition, it's a matter of consequences. And I haven't filled this in yet because I'm not sure exactly how to do it. but somebody might be able to help me on this from the Aristotelian tradition. No, no, it's a matter to be done by virtuous agents. And I'm open to suggestions as to how to do that one.
But I know enough about, for example, this consequentialist answer to be able to say something about what that would look like. I'm not an ethicist, so I'm kind of reaching here. But you might say, well, on the consequentialist theory, the right action is one that produces the best overall consequences. And that can be defined over on the right. And then there are two forms, act consequentialism and rule consequentialism, where act consequentialism is essentially perform that act that is likely to produce the greatest overall amount of something good that you care about, like, for example, happiness. And now objections come rushing in. For example, you might say, look, doesn't that reach up to a heroic standard? Don't you have to sit and calculate every time that you are deciding what to do? Do some kind of philosophic calculus, as Bentham used to say. Response, well, maybe not. Maybe just doing following some kind of enlightened self-interest is actually the long-term best way to produce the overall amount of happiness. You don't necessarily have to do a detailed calculation. Time, that's a possible reply. Or you might say, what about this? Doesn't the utilitarian approach, this act utilitarian approach, trample individual rights? After all, maybe it seems that there could be cases in which, for example, I don't know, euthanizing someone who's not a great contributor to social well-being, but he'd like to use his organs to save some other people's lives, where those other people in question are likely prodigies who are fantastic at what they do and they really need to have their lives saved and so forth, but we won't miss this guy. You might feel like that would, from a utilitarian point of view or consequentialist point of view, be the right thing to do. And then it seems like the right thing to do is thereby to trample rights, because it seems like he's got a right not to be euthanized for the harvesting of his organs. Seems reasonable enough. And there's more to say about that, but then we could give a reply such as the kind of thing that Transfer Bill seems to be tempted by, that, well, actually, rights are kind of a social construction. Some people call them nonsense upon stilts. Maybe the talk of rights is really just fancy talk for something that we want, but perhaps can't always have. So there are ways in which you can pursue that dialectic. Again, the no time to calculate objection. Notice how it centers around this. You might say, well, I don't have time to calculate. Forget about the heroic standard. I don't have time to calculate as to what to do. It's too complicated to figure out how I'm going to maximize utility. Well, the reply to that might be, well, you know, we've got all these rules about how to behave. Don't look a gift horse in the mouth, and what goes around comes around, and do that himself be true, and so forth. And those kinds of rules of thumb are things that we learned at our mother's or father's or someone else's knee, and they can help us. I don't think I've got anything under that yet. They can help us with negotiating everyday choices. We don't have to do a detailed calculation every time we're deciding what to do, and so on and so forth. So the idea is, you can embody various of the dialectical structure in the form of that you normally get, books and articles and so forth, in a way that makes it visually, I think, very vivid as to what the positions are and what the objections are to which they're prone, and then the responses to which those objections can be. And the responses that can be used to rebut those objections, to defuse them, change them in some way. What I don't know how to do is this, that often what happens when somebody starts out with a philosophical theory, they consider a reply to it, an objection to it, and they find themselves wanting to refine that theory in response to that objection, maybe in response to taking into account some of the reply to that objection and so on. I'm not quite sure how to think about the way in which somebody might refine a dialectic as they go. Seems like the question and the theory which it gives an answer are going to be relatively fixed. But there might be a way in which, for example, below the rule of thumb, as an example of replying to an objection, there might be a way in which you can see how to give a, as it were, reiteration of an already formulated general philosophical theory, but it might be modified in some way. So we might want to think about whether there's a way to recapitulate what's happened before, but in a more refined way, such as that, in such a way that it can respond to that objection. Okay, so those are the two examples that I have as kind of toy examples so far, free will, right acts, but I'm hoping to add tabs and dialectics about things like the nature of justice, about what it means to confirm a theory, about the nature of knowledge, the relation of mind and body, political obligation, things of that sort. And at least for many, these are the topics that I mentioned, the basic theories and the various of the core replies or objections to those theories are relatively well worked out, relatively well established. So I feel like I've got something to sort of start with, some relatively firm foundation to build upon.
And then as things get more complicated, as you get more complex theories, some try to reply to some of the objections to the main theories, the hope is that enough users will begin to start being interested in projects that they can contribute on topics that I'm not a specialist in. A graduate student, for example, working on a dissertation on the topic, could end up building her own dialectic or sub-dialectic and start in part of a larger structure that would help us all understand how to, for example, refine a theory that tries to tell us what our political obligations are or what the relation between mind and body or the nature of the media or something of the sort. So the hope is we start out with things that are the parts of philosophy, the Phil 101 kind of stuff that are relatively well established, and then see how to build those things into things of a more abstract and sophisticated kind, but also in the dialectic. And it's always going to be visually possible, not just conceptually, but also visually possible, to see how your new refined theory, for example, is related to the overall tree. And as things get complicated at more advanced levels, that's, I think, a really good heuristic. Value in order to help see not just what your theory is doing, what your answer to these various questions is doing, but also what kind of options you have, theoretically speaking. So that is the basic idea. I should stop and see if you have any questions.
We'll wait for questions later.
Yeah.
So I think that that's it then.
We'll just play on.
Right, folks, I wonder if we might take about 10 minutes for questions, and then we start at the end of the
As you know, I really enjoyed, all the presentations. They were actually really, really impressive projects, fascinating to learn more details. Your project would be, as a composition, I teach composition, among other things that many of us do, graduate students. Your project would be a really excellent project for mapping out student argument in a collaborative way for our classes. And I wonder if you thought about ways to maybe set up, because this is exactly the problem that we want to think about, is what's the structure of the argument they need to go through, what are the objections that are going to come up, and how might you map that into then a discursive framework? If there was some kind of interactive pedagogical way to set that up, it'd be really useful.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear you're interested in that. I am starting to correspond with Mara Harrell, who is on the philosophy faculty at Carnegie Mellon. And she's developed kind of argument mapping software for, I think, precise purposes like this, not specifically for philosophy. And I'm hoping to figure out exactly how it works and make sense of it and see if there's some way of thinking about it and what she's doing. And if I can, I'll send it your way.
The writing system.
She's very interested in just getting critical thinking on the page happening effectively for undergraduates, but she also has a strong interest in high school level, so that connects with some of what I'm doing. But I think it's generalizable across disciplines, and I think it's a great thing to do. The only thing I would say, and this is out of playing that describing that online project can do anything yet with that either, but generally speaking, as I see hardware mapping, you tend to get two kind of logical structures that are possible, two sort of structures that are possible. Thinking about how to support some ultimate proposition, for example, one of the defensive sort of kind of claim. And you have multiple ways of defending it. Here's a reason, here's another reason. Or you might have, here's a reason, and here's a reason that supports that reason. But in logic, there's a lot more sophistication that's possible, but the argument mapping system, so far as I understand it, doesn't quite harness. So you have if A then B, and A, modus ponens should allow you to infer B. But it's no obvious way that the argument mapping system can do that without giving you a full body symbolic logic, and that's kind of hard to do for students that don't have a full course in that. So I'm not sure how to get more internal structure, so to speak. I mean, the if A, then B, and A, but neither by themselves does any work to get you down to the conclusion of B. They have to work together. How do they link up in such a way to get that conclusion? I don't know the answer to that question, but it's something I'm exercising my help to make progress with. But I'll, if you make sure you talk to me afterwards, I'll get your contact info, and I'll hopefully be able to have tomorrow the press member coming up.
Friends, just kind of add on point, but you put it in this, like Stephen Children's uses of argument.
Yeah.
I was reminded, I mean, was that part of the design? Were you thinking about the way that he maps sort of observations to sort of claim through warrants and backups for warrants? And so he has a sort of a logical structure, but it's not quite logical, I think, is kind of the point that he's making. But that's Is that part of what's being represented in the way that you create these flows?
That's sort of part of the background. Yeah. I want to prize apart that the details, some of the details of what he does and how he does it from a more general system that is more uniform and more widely applicable. But that's sort of part of that. It's just that I don't see a neat way to get the terminological structure represented, and that has to come in at some point. Right. You need to be able to understand how an argument that a student wants to write out is going to be informed. If all A's are B and something's and this thing's an A, therefore this thing's a B, for example. You want to be able to get that. It's not easy to get that in that graphical structure, but there's got to be a way.
Okay, just following up there too, I know your project's at the beginning. But down the horizon, it almost seems like all your endpoints are relative, in the sense that you don't actually say, well, that's a dead end. You don't actually have a way of saying some arguments, in fact, are better than others, because I think you're... So if you compare yours to Ben is making the claim that this is definitive, or at least the best of all possible collections, right? So is there some mechanism that you can envision in an architecture where you can ultimately say, if you go down these particular paths, you end in these objections, which in fact cannot be surmounted.
Yeah.
So it's just not a matter of choosing and saying every choice is as good as every other choice.
Sure, that's a really good question.
Right.
And I have lost some time thinking about it. I'm not sure I'm making progress, but the spirit of Socratic method, I think, is one that doesn't try to do that. If you actually look at Platonic dialogue, Socrates having conversations with his friends and so forth, it hardly ever happens that Socrates says, QED, you are wrong, hold that position. He just does this process where he gets people to see that their position has problems. They generally get some consensus together. That's right.
They only make fun of people.
Often they make fun of people, but it's not, you know, reductio ad absurdum, you are done. There's nothing else left. And I'm hesitant to do that. I guess I'd want to say, at the most, it's one thing to say this position yields a downright contradiction, but there are some people who are going to say, you know, Walt Whitman style, I'm large, I can take multitudes, do I contradict myself? Right, so I'm not so sure I want to say at this point, you know, a buzzer goes off and you've got to go back up in the tree and start again.
But that's a philosophical commitment that you have.
But I'm trying to be as non-committal as I can be.
Right.
And so I'm hoping that most users, students and others, will see the inherent absurdity of some positions and move on and go back up the tree on their own. But I'm disinclined to force the issue. I'm more inclined to let the user see that this position implies the following, I hope most people will be able to see, really unpalatable consequences, but if you want to bite those bullets and take them on, that's your choice. So I'm hesitant about having it be anything more heavy-handed than that. I mean, I want to let the user have the options.
I like the fact that it already includes and to me, I get an aura of people have thought about this question before.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's not pompous at all, but it's so appealing as kind of saving, it's time saving almost, that it's, this is not the first time it's been asked. There are these positions, they lead to these consequences, and the user is sort of getting into a dialogue with these
things. That's right. And I very much don't want, you know, I envision a 16-year-old from Omaha trying to mess around with this, and I don't want, you know, images of statues or guys with long, you know, curly wigs on them, you know, lightness and like that, bearing down with them, staring at them on high, saying, you really got to think. I want that to come later if it comes at all. Mostly I want them to engage with the questions. And it happens that some famous person had a lot to say about this. That's good, and good things that I know later on, but I'm inclined to downplay that at the beginning. And then I'm hoping later on, if you want, you can click on stuff on the right of the screen and say, what are the historical antecedents of this? Or who said this? And how were they responded to by other people? That should, I think, be a later step in the development of the project. But even then, it's hardly ever, and so-and-so was decisively refuted by Kant, and that's the end of the story, something like that. But rather, it's just a constant process. And that's what I really want to promote. So I'm inclined to let more flowers bloom than fewer at this point, and let the user come to realize after sleeping on her or something like that, that she should at least consider trying another path down the tree.
Okay.
as opposed to saying, wrong, try again. I just think that's not in the spirit of this fragment. That's what I'm thinking.
I wonder if I could ask Allison a question, and then, then we should probably break. The method you described contrasts rather starkly, I think, with the sort of readings that Steve was describing this morning, in so much as those are sort of the scholar's intervention is in the designing of the tool, right? And then the tool runs and you get word frequencies out, right? And that's sort of the magic moment, right? Because the text is read by the machine. If I understood the best schema you were describing, someone's reading it and marking it up. Is that at the paragraph level, am I right? Sort of paragraph
level? Yeah, we
don't
go below the... I mean, there's discussion, but basically the text here is the paragraph.
Okay. I'm wondering how you do that. Who's doing the reading? And I'm also wondering how concerned you are about enforcing something like standard sort of definitions on your vocabulary so we all agree that this is an event type whatever. I'm wondering sort of what are the practicalities of that?
Well, that's exactly the challenge. So far it's been myself and some graduate research assistants, one of them's in the room, and other people have been helping with the database, other graduate students. But the best analysis, I, of course, developed the schema, and it's based on having read masses of these books and then looking at particular narratives. For a while, we team edited so that three or four people would edit the same thing and we'll see if there's any kind of consensus. And now what we're doing, as people are getting trained and as I'm more sure of how the whole thing works, each person is doing a separate narrative, but then another team member is vetting it. But we have these meetings in which we sort of say, we need a control value for this, and this isn't making sense. I mean, and I go through periodically to try to prune out the duplications and make the set of options, the values that you can put in these tags, efficient. But, it's a kind of insane level of human interpretation. But that is actually, I would polemically say, is what's interesting. So it is standardizing, but it is understanding that a team of editors is going to slightly disagree. We always agree about stage of life without too much trouble. And I think any time we would actually talk it through, we would get to a consensus. But it's going to be doing this kind of demonstration that human interpretation is going to vary. But when we aggregate, 19 versions of one person's life and compare them to 14, to 19, obviously you try to, any statistics are going to try to be careful statistics, but you still will see interesting patterns which should be visualizable and should give people a picture of what the whole subgenre is doing. And what kinds of roles of women were being generated in this discourse. But I really think the tool ought to be adaptable to other people's projects.
All right. Steve, and then we'll break for 5 minutes.
The method, the approach.
Yeah, this I think you just answered my question about the last one. You just said, you developed a schema based on reading massive amounts of material. But what strikes me, I think this is a commonality to all three presentations, which I enjoyed very much, that is that, we can say, the experience of women, the history, say their familial and marital situations have been complex and varied. And the computer always asks, really, what were those situations? List them. The answer to questions about do we have free will, real philosophical answers. Well, it's very complicated, and what do you mean by free will? And the computer is waiting. Well, no. What list them? What are the answers to that? What are the possible answers to that question? And I guess I wanted to sort of invite you to reflect on what is that process itself useful to you? Having to sort of contend with this thing that this machine that really wants you to actually say what are the different kinds of, because it runs against, I think we like to say it's complex and multifaceted and varied, but the computer, struggles with multifaceted and varied. And so I wonder if that was pretty...
Well, when I was writing the book, I was doing computational things by hand, and I really should have been working with a computer. Because I got interested in the subgenre, and, now we have 1,200, there were about 900 books at the time that I published the book. And it's the labor is annoying, but the results schema, having known the material pretty well, but I don't see any other way around that. But we will find out the quantifiable results. Well, I think it'd be really interesting.
With a whole bunch of tests, if you could do a word search without categorized, or if you could do a word search anyway, across them all, it's this laboratory that you can pose questions that you could never get an answer to without the computer. But then you can realize, well, it's not just you actually, if you read through the law, you would be able to come up with the same results, but you can see where the leads are and where the dead ends are, where the richness lies, where maybe new questions are fully further along.
And I just want to add that I think it's really useful to be forced to set down what are the possible answers, how do they differ from each other. Is this one or not know that? How was this really a response to that claim? Is it really a response, or is it just kind of frogging its mouth or?
Yeah, I mean, sort of like act consequentialism. Mm-hmm. Isn't it unified? I mean, that itself refers to a massive discourse that is not itself unified.
That's right, right?
And you have to say.
I'm going to have to. That's right. I'm going to have to force it into some kind of structure. But of course, somebody could always say, and it's always it's within the constraints of the system to say, that itself. Bifur, trifur, something else, case to a lot of different subspecies, and then things get more complicated, and then we can just see how it's working. So I think it's very helpful to be forced to sort of set it out, and then if you feel like you're missing something, go on the branch, or retrieve that, and see what happens. And that process might be ongoing. I just think that's the kind of research and philosophy that I personally find most exciting, not necessarily a brand new theory out of the blue, but rather a new and subtle answer to a question. We've been worried about the question for 2,000 years, but it wasn't until 30 years ago that someone actually figured out that it's possible to answer the question that way. That's great, representing the truth. So I think it's healthy to be forced to articulate that stuff, and I would also want to always keep looking over my shoulder, wondering whether there's still might be more subtlety and depth that I'm missing. That's always possible.
That's very wonderful thoughts for our guests.